I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Yaman Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. Yaman started Patagonia in 1973, and the company exemplifies social and environmental responsibility. Some of its efforts include donating 1% of sales to environmental efforts, making its cotton sportswear 100% organic, having a child care center on its premises, and reducing its energy use by 60%. In addition to being the founder of Patagonia, Yaman is a rock climber, surfer, and fly fishing enthusiast. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to talk about falconry because that really is the germ or the origination for Patagonia, ultimately, indirectly. Where did your interest in falconry come from when you were in your teens?
Well, I think it was just early teens, in fact. I don't know. I read a National Geographic article from a 1920 Geographic by the Frank and John Craighead about hawks and falcons, and I just got interested in it. And I got in with some other young fellows, and we started kind of a little club of falconers and would go around and climbing to hawks' nests and taking birds and training them, and then but also banding birds for the U.S. government and stuff.
Now, this was in Southern California?
That was in, yeah.
Your family lived in Maine before moving to Southern California. Why did they move?
Yeah, well, we moved when I was about 7 years old because my father had asthma, and my mother thought the climate would be better for him in California.
And for the first 7 years of your life, you went to a French-speaking Catholic school.
And that's right.
You spoke only French at home, too?
Yeah, this was in Lisbon, Maine, and everybody spoke French in Lisbon, Maine. They were all French-Canadians who came down from Canada to work in the woolen mills.
And when you moved to California and you started speaking English, do you remember that transition for you?
Yeah, it was tough. You know, as soon as we got to California, I was put in public school, and everybody, of course, spoke English. And I remember a few days later, I just ran away from school. That kind of set me on a different path the rest of my life.
Do you remember where you ran to?
No, I can't even remember that far back.
What are some other examples of your difficulty in adjusting?
Well, you know, in high school was a horror for me. I mean, you know, I had pimples. I was the shortest guy in school. I certainly didn't go to the prom, that's for sure. I was probably down in the bottom of the LA River gigging frogs and catching crawdads. And I mean, I've had a life in nature all my life, really, and it's saved my life.
Do you have any friends from your high school years or from your childhood? Or were you?
No.
What did your parents do?
My father was a tradesman. He could build an entire house by himself. He was a plumber, electrician, carpenter, mason. Could do everything. Mm. Even though he only went to school till third grade, and that was it.
And how about you? When did you stop going to school?
I actually went to 2 years of college in a junior college in California. At the time, I was working part time as a private detective. My brother owned a private detective agency, and 18 years old, 19 years old, I was working as a private detective and going to school. But one day, I just was standing in line waiting to get my books for the next semester, and I just walked away, and it's the best thing I've ever done. I think I knew what I wanted to do, which was at that time I was doing a lot of climbing, and I wanted to make climbing equipment.
I want to dig into this private investigation, private detective work. What are some cases that you looked at?
Well, I was mainly working for Howard Hughes. This is when he was hiding out in a Beverly Hills hotel, and they were trying to subpoena him. And he had a whole bunch of so-called starlets all around town. And my job was to tail these starlets, and it's just all hanky-panky stuff.
And for those who don't know who Howard Hughes is, who is Howard Hughes?
Well, he was a Hollywood mogul. He was a pilot. He was quite a character. But in his later years, he was pretty crazy, and he did a lot of crazy things, and which required a lot of private detectives.
But your calling was in the wilderness.
Yeah, that's right.
We talk about falconry being the genesis of all this. What does falconry have to do with rock climbing?
Well, I learned to climb by climbing to falcons' eyries.
Eyries are the homes of falcons?
Yeah, that's the nest up on cliffs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's how I learned to climb, you know, using old manila ropes and not really knowing what we were doing, because there was no schools on climbing in those days. You had to learn the hard way, taking a lot of risk and barely coming out alive. Training falcons got me interested a lot in kind of Zen Buddhism philosophy. And my first lesson was basically trying to train a wild falcon. And you trap one and you put it on your fist and you put these jessies on his feet. And you try to stay up all night with him until he finally falls asleep. And that builds trust in the bird very quickly. But, you know, the Zen master's got to say, you know, who's getting trained here? You know, you got a 12-year-old kid having to stay up all night until this bird finally falls asleep.
So you developed this interest in rock climbing because you wanted to go to the nests of these falcons.
That's right.
At the time, this is in the late 40s, early 50s, there was no infrastructure for climbing. What equipment did you use?
Well, in the beginning, we used, you know, Converse tennis shoes to climb in. There were no climbing shoes. Then we started getting some equipment from Europe, and specifically pitons, you know, the spikes that you drive into the rocks. And in those days, the pitons were made out of soft steel because the European attitude towards climbing was to conquer the mountains and make them easier for the next party. Hmm. You know, that's kind of the manifest destiny that created America, really. You know, tame the wilderness. But we were brought up with the philosophy of John Muir and Thoreau and Emerson and, you know, the American naturists who believe that you shouldn't alter nature and just you should go into nature and leave no trace of having been there. So I wanted to make some pitons out of hard steel and so that you could use them over and over. And they worked really, really well.
And this was when you were roughly 19, 20 years old.
That's right.
You became essentially a blacksmith.
I borrowed some money from my folks and went out and bought an anvil and a coal-fired forge and got some steel from the junkyard and pounded out my first pitons. And I used them for myself, and then friends wanted some, and then friends of friends. And then pretty soon we were on the cutting edge of rock climbing, these huge walls in Yosemite, you know, that take 10 days. And in fact, you had to have my equipment if you were going to do that climb. You know, I've been a craftsman all my life, kind of, and I love working with my hands. And I love looking at a product and saying, you know, I can make that better. I'm not an inventor, but I'm an innovator.
You mentioned Yosemite. You also would hide out in Yosemite when you you were overstaying your visit. What was that about?
Well, you're only allowed to, in those days, spend 2 weeks in Yosemite. Well, you can't do much climbing in 2 weeks. Some of those climbs we were doing would be on the wall for 10 days. And so, you know, we'd spend months there. So we were outlaws. We were basically hiding, living in the boulder fields. And
eating what?
Well, I remember 1958, I guess, I took off for the summer and I stopped by this store in San Francisco that sold damaged cans, and I bought cases of damaged cat food and 10 cents a can. And, you know, I spent the summer eating porcupines and ground squirrels and whatever I could scavenge. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we did.
So here you are, you're pioneering all this equipment for the rock climbing industry out of necessity. Where did it go from there?
Well, it turned into a business. I mean, and it wasn't just rock climbing equipment. I mean, we kind of reinvented all the ice climbing gear. In fact, the stuff was so advanced, so ahead of its time that nobody even knew how to use it. So that was the first book I wrote. I had to write a book on how to ice climb, which kind of revolutionized ice climbing.
You were producing objects that literally supported your life, and that requires a good deal of confidence. I would never trust myself to build a device, that really had my life in its hands. How did you feel about that?
Well, we were very careful, and at the time, I had a partner, Tom Frost, and the two of us were designing and making this stuff. We were the only ones that did all the quality control and everything. I would take buckets of these pitons or carabiners or other tools at home and do all the inspection and quality control myself. And we had an attitude of making the absolute best climbing gear in the world. That was our philosophy. And
And the name of your company was Chouinard Equipment.
that's right.
You were pioneering this equipment, but at the same time, you were harming the rocks,
Well,
even though
that's,
you were reusing the pitons.
yeah. When I first started climbing, there was only maybe 250 serious climbers in America. But in the 70s, the sport kind of exploded, and more climbers doing the same routes over and over again. And they're putting in these hard steel pitons in the cracks and taking them out. And pretty soon we're realizing that it's leaving a big hole in the crack. So I felt that, okay, this is our fault. And so I felt, okay, since it's our fault, we need to be the ones to do something about it. And so we put at risk 80% of our sales in pitons and switched over almost overnight to a different method of protecting climbing by these little aluminum chocks that you put into the a constriction in the crack with your fingers, and you pull it out with your fingers, and it causes no harm whatsoever.
And when you're on these climbs, what part of your interest in climbing is the physical versus wanting some solitary moments?
Well, I don't think solitary has much to do with it, but I think the purpose of climbing is to affect some sort of spiritual or physical growth, and it has everything to do with how you get up there. Well, like if you climb in Yosemite, you get to the top of a 10-day climb, and there's nothing there. There's just a forest, and that kind of is the opposite of. Say some high-powered businessman paying $85,000 to be guided up Mount Everest, and what's important to him is to get to the top, not how you get to the top. And that's wrong. That's not what climbing is about.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvonne Chouinard, founder of Patagonia. We'll hear more from Yvonne coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Yvonne Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. In addition to being the founder of Patagonia, Yvonne is a rock climber, surfer, and fly fishing enthusiast. What about the life of the mind? I mean, you were very active with your hands and climbing, yet you didn't enjoy school at all. What did you do to exercise your brain's development?
Well, I've been a book reader all my life, and so for a couple of years there, I was drafted into the Army when I was 21, I think, and so I decided to read 100 books while I was in the Army.
By the way, what did your mother do? You mentioned what your dad did.
My mother was a housewife, but my father was not an adventurer. My mother was the one that really wanted to travel and really wanted. She liked change. I'm much more like my mother than my father.
Except for the working with the hands
That's
component.
right.
So, what happened to Chouinard Equipment, this company?
Well, eventually, I sold it in the early 80s to the employees because I had started Patagonia, the clothing company, in 1973, and I was trying to run two companies. I couldn't do that. It was just too much. And now it's called Black Diamond. And they continue to make the best climbing gear in the world.
We mentioned before how Patagonia came from falconry. Falconry developed your interest in rock climbing. And then when you were rock climbing, you started wearing rugby shirts. And rugby shirt was really the germ of Patagonia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was on a climbing trip to Scotland in the winter, and I came back from the trip And I had bought a rugby shirt because I thought, hey, this is a cool shirt. And it's got a collar, so it worked really good for climbing because it was really tough material. The collar was protecting the gear sling from your neck. And it came in, you know, some bright colors and stuff. And at that time, men's sportswear had no color to it at all. All it was gray sweatshirts and sweatpants. That was it. And here I'm wearing this bright blue rugby shirt with the yellow and red stripes on it. And people were saying, wow, where'd you get that? And so the lights came on. I started importing a few, and they sold like crazy. And it started a whole fashion. That's how I got into the clothing business.
And why did you name it Patagonia?
Well, in 1968, I took a trip with my friend Doug Tompkins and three other guys.
He's the founder of North Face and Esprit.
We drove from California to the tip of South America, and I fell in love with that part of the world called Patagonia, the southern part of Argentina and Chile. And I wanted to start making clothing, and I thought Patagonia would be a good name because that's the kind of conditions I wanted to make clothing for, you know, ferocious winds and storms and these icy peaks. And I thought that would be a good name for a company.
You started the company in 1973. You were in your early 30s at the time. What was going on with your personal life?
When I was 32, I guess, I married my wife, Melinda, and she got involved in the business. And, you know, a few years later, we started having kids, and the company grew. And she is much more of a people person than I am, and she's been very good at HR problems. And she was responsible for starting a child care center, which when we did that, you know, before we did that, we had employees coming to work with their kids in a cardboard box on their desk.
trying to hide the child.
Yeah, I mean, we've always operated like a different style business, like a family. So we wanted our family close to us. We didn't want to just leave home and leave the kids at home and drag ourselves back to work. And it turned out we had some screaming babies that were affecting everybody's work. So she thought, hey, it's a good idea to put in an on-site child care center. And at that time, there was only 50 in the whole United States.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvon Chouinard, founder of the clothing company Patagonia. So we're talking about the early days. How did you finance the company initially?
Well, it was we were self-financed, which works up to a point. The problem is we came out with a product that we call Cinchilla, which was a fleece. We were the first ones to come out with this. And when we did, it took off. And our growth, I mean, we were growing 50% a year. So we were growing 50% a year for several years, and you can't do that on retained earnings. You're gonna end up in financial problems. So we got in a really big financial trouble, and at the same time, there was a recession. And we had planned to do 50% that year. We bought the inventory, we hired the people, and we only grew 30%. We couldn't borrow any more from the bank. In fact, our bank was in financial trouble. In fact, my accountant introduced me to some mafia guys who wanted to lend me some money at 28% interest, which ironically is what people pay with their credit cards now. So anyway, I had to do a lot of soul searching. So I took about 10 of our top people down to Patagonia. We walked around for about 10 days and would walk for a while and then sit down and say, okay, what are we doing anyway? Why are we in business? None of us had a degree in business, not one person. We all had degrees in biology and English and sociology and anthropology. And you know, I had a degree from John Burroughs High School in auto mechanics.
Was that, by the way, on purpose, that none of your employees had any background in business?
Yeah, we didn't want to hire any greaseballs.
And so here you are financially strapped in a recession, and you say, how are we going to rectify the situation? Let's go to Patagonia.
Well, it's the best thing we ever did. Because, you know, we were able to write down why we were in business. The farmer has a responsibility to leave the farm in better shape than he received it. The forester has a responsibility to leave the forest, take a few trees out of the forest and not clear cut it and leave it in good shape. But somehow business is exempt from having any responsibility to do that. So we decided to put our business on a 100-year track, which means we had to control our growth to, you know, 5% or certainly less than 10% a year. So we don't artificially create a demand. We don't put ads on inner city buses to try to get the gang kids to wear our black down jackets rather than North Face. We keep trying to sell to people who need the product rather than want the product. And that got us out of this crazy growth that caused all our problems.
So you didn't have to raise any capital?
No, we didn't have to raise. Well, you know, I had to borrow money from friends and things like that. But I did have to lay off a bunch of employees that we had hired, which was something that I swore I would never do again.
How much capital did you put into the business initially?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It's year to year. I don't really know.
So are we talking like $300,000, $30,000, $3 million? You don't recall at all?
No, I really don't.
Even which decimal place were
you? No.
We talked about the recession, but what else was challenging for you?
Well, I still don't like the business part of it. The hardest part is finding the right people to work for you. If I'm interviewing somebody across the desk from me, I'm horrible at it because I believe everything they say. And so now when I interview somebody, I bring in a bunch of women who see right through everybody. They're much better at it than I am. For sure. I've made a lot of mistakes in hiring the wrong people.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about falconry, you alluded to Zen Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
What influence does that have on your outlook?
I mean, some people approach Zen Buddhism by meditating. I kind of approach it through action. And I've applied it in all my sports and applied it in business. Like, for instance, if you ask me what our profits were last year, I completely forgot. I have no idea what they were. I have no idea what they're going to be this year. I couldn't care less. I'm focused on the process. And if you're focused on the process of business, the profits come.
Now, for those who don't know about Zen Buddhism, what is like the central tenet of Zen Buddhism?
Well, I don't really know, actually. I wouldn't be able to answer that. And probably the Zen master would probably say the same thing. Well, you know, I mean, people say, okay, you've been a risk taker all your life. I don't take any risk at all. I do my homework. And if you do your homework, you don't take any risk. And like, for instance, I've been a whitewater kayaker and doing dangerous rivers, first descents of rivers and things like that. But the day I really learned how to kayak is I did a river next to my house in Wyoming. That is a difficult river, and it falls, you know, more than 100 feet a mile. And I did it one day without a paddle. If you don't have a paddle, you have to think way ahead. You have to be seated correctly in the seat. And you basically have to go down a river like a fish. And I did that, and I had a perfect run. And so people say, well, that was a crazy thing to do. That was really risky. You know what? It wasn't risky. The worst that could have happened is I would have lost my boat and picked it up a few miles down, and I would have swam out. But by taking small risk, it gave me the confidence and the technique to not be so dependent on my paddle. And so then I went on and did lots of first descents of very dangerous rivers because of taking a small risk in the beginning. And so in business, that's how I operate my business. We take lots of small little so-called risks so that we don't take the big ones.
You do not use email, and you constantly lose your cell phone. I think you dropped it in the toilet or the river recently.
I actually hate all electronics. I don't even know how to turn on my television. And I think it goes back to when my father was an electrician. When I was a little kid, he'd say, hey, come on over here. And he'd stick his hand in an electrical outlet and then grab my hand and give me a shock, and he'd laugh. Ever since then, I've hated electronics. But yeah, I don't have a computer. I try to live a simple life. So I'm slowly getting rid of a lot of stuff.
A friend of yours said, behind every Luddite is a woman with a computer.
My wife is the most wired woman in America.
So what does cause you the most angst if you're striving to get rid of so-called stuff? What provides you with the most anxiety?
Certainly, I feel guilty about flying all over the world and doing these sports. I mean, I'm certainly going to be in that seventh level of hell that's fueled with jet fuel. But I try, you know, not to fly first class or fly in private airplanes or any of that stuff, which is even worse.
So that's the stuff that burdens you.
Yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvonne Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. You made a switch to all organic cotton in the 1980s. And for thousands of years, farmers have been producing cotton organically. Why did farmers start using pesticides to grow cotton?
Well, it's not just cotton. Pesticides all started from World War II, pretty much. From a lot of the toxic things that they use in war. Yeah, before World War II, everything was pretty much organic. I mean, the lights came on for me one day when we put a store in Boston. We outfitted an old building and we redid it, and it was springtime. We brought in all our sportswear.
On Newberry Street?
Yeah, on Newberry Street. And within a few days, our employees were complaining of getting headaches. So I brought in an environmental engineer, and he checked things out. He said, your ventilation system is recycling the same air, and you're poisoning your employees. I said, well, what are they getting poisoned with? Well, formaldehyde, he says. He says, it's all on that sportswear that you have out there, all that cotton clothing. I said, what? Then I find out that a label that says 100% pure cotton is, on the average, 73% cotton. The rest are chemicals put on the cotton afterwards to control shrinkage and pilling and wrinkling, stuff like that. The most common chemical is formaldehyde. You know, in biology class, you got a lizard in a jar, and that jar is filled with formaldehyde. It's really toxic, and we're all wearing it. Well, I said, I don't want to be in business if I have to use formaldehyde, which led us to realize that we didn't know what we were doing. We were just buying cloth and, you know, already dyed and just making clothing. So that's when we decided to work on an environmental philosophy. And I gave the company 18 months to get out of that game, even though it was, you know, 25% of our business. Well, that got everybody's attention. And I've never seen the business operate better. So, I mean, we had to go in partnership with some farmers and lend them money so that they could buy their seed, because the bank wouldn't lend them anything because the banks are in collusion with the chemical companies. And I mean, it was, and then, you know, the spinner wouldn't spin our cloth because the cotton came in with seeds and stems and sticks, and it was sticky because of aphids. You know, those little white bugs that you get on your garden, and it makes it real sticky. So the stuff was sticky, wouldn't go through the machines, and finally we found, you know, one spinner in Thailand who developed a process of freezing the cotton before he put it in. And I mean, it was very, very difficult to pull it off, but we have not used 1 ounce of non-organic cotton since 1986.
What are some of the current initiatives going on in the industry?
We've been involved with a bunch of very large apparel companies and retail companies in creating a sustainability index for clothing. We have probably 60% of the apparel market in the world represented in this group of companies, and we're leading it. Our little company, Patagonia, is leading this, and what we're doing is going to end up where somebody can walk into a department store and there'll be 5 pairs of jeans, and they'll be able to zap their iPhone or whatever electronic thing they have onto the barcode, and it'll give a grade, and it'll tell you the whole history of that product. And you'll be able to make a decision as to which one of those 5 brands of jeans you want to buy, according to how responsibly they were made. That's a huge revolution.
Although, you know, the word organic is so hackneyed these days, you don't really know what organic means anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we want to do this ourselves. We don't want the government to do it. It's just like, you know, I didn't wait for the Rangers in Yosemite to tell me to stop making hard steel pitons. We decided to do it ourselves. We think that we'll have much more stringent and more truthful index if we do it without the government.
you have a program called 1% for the Planet where you donate 1% of your sales or 10% of your profits, whichever mm-hmm. is greater. Can you describe that a little more?
Yeah, it usually ends up 1% of sales. We look at it as being a cost of doing business because we're polluters. There's no way you can make a product that's sustainable. There's no such thing as sustainability. We feel guilty about what we're doing, using up non-renewable resources and making, you know, a lot of sportswear and things like that. So we take that 1% and we give it to about 450 different environmental organizations.
And so what are sales roughly?
We're 350 million.
Okay, so that's about $3.5 million a year.
Yeah, we've given away about $40 million over the years.
Incidentally, can I see your hands for a second? They're well worn.
Oh, they're worn, all right. My whole body's well worn. There's a lot of internal damage.
What occupies your time these days? You're not doing blacksmithing anymore. You're not as
I still do it, but I do it as that's my sandbox.
So what do you make in your sandbox?
Oh, I make like the other day I made some crampons that you put on your feet for wading real slimy, rocky rivers. So it's a fishing product. And I made it in my blacksmith shop, and I was just in British Columbia testing it. And then I make, you know, I make hinges for houses. I make fireplace sets. I make all kinds of different things. But I have to work with my hands every day. And like I cook at home. If I've been pushing papers around all day, I have to go cut vegetables or do something. I have to do something on a daily basis.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
My guest has been Yvonne Chouinard, founder of Patagonia. Coming up, we'll meet Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Men, a company that creates music cruise events. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man, a travel company focused on creating unique music events for music fans. Sixth Man organizes cruises that feature concerts with artists including John Mayer, Sarah McLachlan, Leonard Skinner, and Bare Naked Ladies. By spending a few days on a boat, fans receive a more direct experience with their favorite bands. Andy started Sixth Man in 2001 when he was 30 years old, and more than 30,000 fans have attended a concert cruise hosted by Sixth Man. Welcome.
Thank you.
Where did you come up with the name Sixth Man?
When I was in high school, I played basketball, and I wasn't the starter, but I was what they call the sixth man. It refers to, in basketball, the first man off the bench. They're not a starter, but they play a lot during the game, normally a utility player. And on my high school basketball team, that's what I was. I wasn't tall enough or good enough to start, but I often came off the bench when someone was hurt or in foul trouble, and really I was the hustler. And then when I got to college, I joined a band, and I wasn't very good at guitar, but I booked all the gigs. And so, again, there was this parallel starting to develop in my life. And then I began managing a band, and my focus was almost 100% on the relationship between the band and their fans, who I consider like their sixth man. So when I needed a name, I felt like Sixth Man was the consistent theme in my life, where I was the happiest and doing the best, the most impactful was when I was playing that role. So it made sense.
You grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. Your dad was an insurance broker, and your mom ran a shopping mall. How did you get the music bug?
My dad played guitar with my uncles. They would just play on the weekends and stuff, nothing professionally. So I was always around it, and my family was really into it. I think it wasn't until I got to the University of Florida that I was in college. You know, that's when you're most likely to join a band, I guess. And so I just, you know, I guess something just came alive, and I wanted to play guitar, and I learned, and there you go.
What role did you play in the band?
I played acoustic guitar and harmonica. And then the big joke was that they didn't have me plugged in for the first year I was in the band. I didn't know that, right? Because I'm on stage, and, you know, it's often the artist can't hear what the audience hears. And they used to play a joke where they'd be like, Andy, take a solo. And they all knew, and I would be back there, you know, doing this stuff. And the audience was looking at you like a puppy dog, you know, like, what's going on?
So if they thought that you weren't even talented enough to be plugged in, why did they want you in the band?
Because I booked all the gigs. I did all the work. You know, they felt like they were in a arena rock band because they just showed up and it was all ready to go. They used to say it's Andy Levine on rhythm guitar and PR. That was my introduction.
Did you ever think about doing something other than music promotion or music, anything related to music?
I think that I probably would have wanted to be like a coach of some sort, or maybe even a teacher. I was kind of just waiting for my entrepreneurial spirit to strike out, and I have some great instances I can remember where that happened.
What are some instances of your entrepreneurial expressions growing up?
Well, I remember when I was 16, I decided I wanted to start a company called Bagels on Wheels. I felt like people would want to have bagels and donuts delivered to their door every Saturday morning, and I figured out a way where I could make a good living doing that, and then I couldn't get anyone to sign up for that to be a customer, so that didn't work.
So here you are, your band is not successful enough to for you to make a living at it, and you end up in Florida at a record store?
I was working as a club called Rickenbacker's, actually, and it was a small club that was not doing very well. And being in the band, I had been to different colleges around the Southeast and noticed they had a pretty vibrant or thriving live original music scene where bands were playing, getting paid to play their own songs. And there were some bands that were really successful, like Hootie and the Blowfish and Dave Matthews and Edwin McCain at the time. And so I felt like no one was doing that at the University of Florida, yet here we were in Florida, very desirable, lots of kids or lots of students. And so I asked this club owner, I said, hey, let me try to bring some of these bands in. And he said, all right, let's try it. And he said, how much do you want? I said, I don't want anything. I want half the profit. I want no salary. Mm-hmm. And we had a good time.
You were promoting these concerts at mm-hmm. the University of Florida, and then you became a manager for bands like Creed and Sister Hazel. You had a pretty intimate relationship with Sister Hazel. How did you go about launching Sixth Man and your first cruise concert?
It wasn't until 2001 and focusing on building the street team for Sister Hazel, which is the unit, their army that promotes them, leads the grassroots charge. Those bands, those fans kind of demanded a convention with the band. They felt like they had done everything we'd asked them to do to help promote the bands, let us sleep on their couch, put up flyers, call radio stations, buy the CDs, come to shows, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, yeah, they're right. They have done all those things. And so I went to the band and I said, guys, we got to do something for our street team. They've done everything. They've been amazing. And they said, let's do something. So we did a cruise in 2001 and we just invited 400 fans and we were scared to death. Mm-hmm. And some of the people in the company didn't even go because they're like, Andy, the band's going to fire us for trapping them on the ship with their fans. And I said, you know what? I'm not impressed with the music business right now anyway. If that's the way it's going to go down, then let it be. I had nothing to lose. As soon as we get on the ship, I told the guys, we're going to buy drinks for the fans for an hour and a half. You're going to have a Sharpie. We're going to make a toast to the fans. And I want you to walk around and sign everything you can and take every picture. Don't let them come to you. Go do it. Just go work the room.
Because the fans helped promote them.
They did. And I'm glad we did that because that really worked. And it set the tone. It said, hey, we appreciate what you've done. Let's have a great time. It's just us. We're out in the ocean. This is the essence of the music business, the bands and their fans on vacation. I got off the cruise and I felt like I had forgot I was in the music business. That's how pure it was. And so I said, I want to build this. This is it. And I called a few other managers that had bands similar to Sister Hazel, who had 400 or 500 fans. I said, I had this idea. We just did something really cool. Would you guys consider doing it? And they said, you get the whole ship and we'll be there. Well, then I realized you need $750,000 to get a ship for a weekend, a year in advance.
If you're reserving the whole ship, then you need $750,000.
Up front. So when we wanted to go from 400 people to the 2,000 people that it would take to do a full ship charter, the cruise line wasn't really sympathetic to my needs because here I was as some guy with an idea, and I'm sure they get that all the time. In fact, now I know they get that all the time. What I decided to do was, after I talked to those other bands, their managers that said they'd be there if we got the whole ship, then we put up a website and we started promoting the fact that we wanted people to let us know if they'd be interested. So we kind of left it open and we said, if you put a $99 refundable deposit down, that'll give us a way to gauge interest. And we got 1,000 people to put a $99 deposit down. And we figured our break even was right around $1,600 or $1,500. So I took that data and I found two local businessmen in Atlanta who kind of loved what we did, loved our spirit and probably could identify with it a bit because they were entrepreneurs themselves. And they loaned me $750,000. I remember two things about this. I remember going to the guy's house to get the check, and I was looking around, his wife and family. I said, how much money do you have to write a 30-year-old a $750,000 check? Because certainly this isn't your last $750,000. You know, what is it? The second thing was that once he gave us the money, I noticed after the first day, there was like a 3 or 4 day gap before we had to wire it to the cruise line. And I noticed we were making like $250 a day in interest. And, you know, at the time I was like, wow, that's a lot of money. I mean, that's more than we make on any day. And that's just for doing nothing. So I just remember like it was my first dealing with that kind of sum of things. And looking back, it was crazy. I mean, why he did it was just crazy. It doesn't make sense why he did it. And we ended up, I think we made $42,000 the first year.
So what is the answer to that question? If somebody's just going to write you a $750,000 check because he likes what you're doing, how much is that person worth?
I think he was worth about $15 million at the time.
How did this individual make his money?
He built a company that offers services to the auto industry, etched glass, extended warranties. And he had sold his company to Ford. Fast forward 5 years, he bought it back from Ford in 2008. And I think he bought it back for less than he sold it for. So,
I notice on your site you talk about living loud. Like that's part of your mantra for Sixth Man is live loud. I'm wondering if that naturally cuts off a certain demographic. What is the demographic of your base?
Well, live loud to us is basically identifying what your passion is and pushing it as far as you can while still being responsible to the rest of your life. We've done cruises, like you said, with Elvis. We've done cruises with Kid Rock, John Mayer. And the one thing I'll tell you, and you have to see this to believe it, is that everyone that steps on that ship, whether they're 25 years old or they're 65 years old, they have the exact same attitude and approach to life. And they're not going to bed early. And we're making sure that, you know, we got people, I mean, they're living. And they've come in there for one reason. They've saved up all year or whatever it is. And they are there to celebrate this passion. It's the purest form of your passion.
And it's a huge party for 3 days on a ship.
I always tell people there's three crowds you can run with. There's the crowd that's going to run all day. And if you want to jump in there and try to run with them, go for it. There's the crowd that'll, you know, they'll stay up till 12 midnight and they'll push a little bit. And there's the crowd that just, you know, they keep a normal balancing. They're in the gym in the morning. They do a couple of things, have a nice dinner, see a show, but they're in bed. So you just kind of pick your crowd.
And what crowd are you in?
You know, I started in the Top Gun, you know, the first 4 or 5 years. So I started out there, and now I'm a little more in the middle crowd, I would say.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man, a travel company focused on creating unique musical events for music fans. Andy started Sixth Man in 2001. You have a blog on the Sixth Man website, and you spoke recently about starting your own company, and you talk about the dip, a term by Seth Godin, the author. You're talking about whether you quit when you're running some type of endeavor or you stick it out. You said that average kills you and horrible saves you. What do you mean by that?
Well, Seth Godin, I've read some of his books over the last few years, and as of late, there's a book he wrote called Tribes, and then he had another book called The Dip, which is like saying it's okay to quit. Like, don't beat your head against the wall. I have a father-in-law who's in this situation where he's running a print store. He's been doing it for 20 years. Nothing has changed. I see him, you know, twice a year. We go to lunch, and I have the same conversation. I said, why are you doing it? You know, what's going to make you change? And so I feel like it's kind of like I was in the band. I feel like people get stuck in it, whether it's relationships or jobs or, you know, ventures or whatever it is. An average can confuse you. Whereas if you're horrible, like my donut, Bagels on Wheels, where I got no customers, it was pretty easy. Or horrible, like the first girl I ever kissed, she's now a nun. That's horrible. See, if it had been okay, you know what? We might have dated, and it would have taken us a long time to realize we weren't for each other. There are some moments where it's just appropriate to say, this isn't working. Or, you know, at least hold yourself accountable to say, I'm going to keep going.
Did you ever face any of those moments while you were launching Sixth Man? Like, okay, is this kind of just average? And should I just kind of quit or stick it out? Or, boy, this is going well. Like, where was your mind as you were launching the company?
That's a great question. I think every entrepreneur has to, like, experience this. I can remember one time after doing the cruise for a couple of years as a charter, we were growing, but it was still a tremendous undertaking and tremendous risk, and we hadn't figured out a way to get the return out of it. But I didn't really care. you know, I could see it. I could see us getting better and better, and I could see the people coming back, and I could see something there. But the other people that were on, that were involved, the investors, were starting to wonder, where's the return? And so there was actually a meeting about whether to do it or not. And I'm like, guys, let's just do it one more year. We can do this, you know. And so we did. And sure enough, that was the year that it kind of tipped. You know, we put this event on sale, and for the first time, it sold out way in advance. The irony in all this is that we were doing it in the fall out of New Orleans. We had one scheduled. We sold it out almost a year in advance. All we had to do was push off, execute, come back, and it would have been a very profitable venture. And 3 weeks before we were supposed to sail, Katrina hit New Orleans. And Carnival leased our ship to FEMA. FEMA, I don't know if you remember, they did the housing on there and they used cruise lines. So I get a call from Carnival one day that says, hey, we're not going to be able to do your program. It's the only, you have to understand, like, I just found out my wife was pregnant with our second child. There was so much pressure for this event to work. And now it was pretty much, we were out of business. So some way I sat down, I wrote a letter to Carnival, and I just kind of outlined all the things we had done and how important it was for them to get us a ship or help figure out a way to make this right. And sure enough, after a couple conversations, I ended up going to the president of the company, and I think they really connected with what we were trying to do, and they, I don't know how they did it, but I got a phone call saying, hey, you know, you're right, and we're going to not only give you the money back that you paid for the ship, but we're going to help you recover all of your expenses and your profit. So, you know, that was a moment. Now, at the same time, you have to understand is that our guest, we had to notify our guest, and so what happened was we started getting phone calls and emails from guests saying, keep my money. Just don't go out of business. I look forward to this all year long. Please. I've met so many great friends. My new best friends I met on this cruise. That's when I knew, like, this is a real family we're building here.
So talk to me about the experience of being on the boat with one of the artists. Let's say John Mayer, for example. You know, I would imagine that the artist is exhausted after playing one night, you know, and the last thing they probably want to do is eat eggs with the fans in the morning when they wake up. And here they have to do it for, you know, 4 days, five, sometimes 7 days. Was there ever any of that concern?
Well, it is. It's still to this day. It's the thing that everyone says, whoa, wait a minute. I'm trapped on a ship for 4 days, you know. But John Mayer, when he first got on the cruise, I don't think he even knew what he was getting into. I think his manager said, hey, let's try this. It'd be great. And he probably said, yeah, whatever. And he didn't think about it. But for John, he got on. I remember we were sailing out. He said, this is genius. He goes, this is genius. He goes, you know, the whole world may think I'm an arrogant jackass, but I'm going to show these people who I really am, because these are the people that care. These are the people that I want to show who I am. And he spent the next 4 days doing just that. He was in the disco every night DJing, and he's a horrible DJ, but he's pouring tequila shots for people. And you know what? People love that. Just watched him have a good time.
It sounds almost like a religious experience for you. Are you religious?
I am. We go to a church in Atlanta called Buckhead Church, and it's about just growing in your relationship, you know, with Jesus. And I feel like since my wife and I have been going there for the last 3 or 4 years, it's really been a really great centering thing for us.
But while you do go to a traditional church every Sunday, do you feel like these events on these ships are church-like, you know, getting a whole community of people together? And is there any of that for you, a spiritual component to
Absolutely.
It?
I know for a I know for a fact that the energy that is created and the moments that are had for people, they have to compete at that level. We have guests send us the letters we get. We have guests send, they send us gifts. They send us lunch. There is some sort of exchange going, and a pure exchange that we're given and they're giving back.
We talk about these highlights on the cruises. What are some events that have happened that you might not want to talk about?
We had a situation with Kid Rock where we were supposed to go to Grand Cayman, and the weather wasn't looking great in Grand Cayman, so we decided the day we left to go to the Bahamas instead. The challenge was there was two couples that were supposed to get married in Grand Cayman, and they had family flying to Grand Cayman. I'm happy to say we figured out a way to get those people married in the Bahamas. Well, one of the couples, the guy pulled me aside and said, maybe this is a sign, so he didn't want to get married. But the other couple, we were able to get them married in the Bahamas. And in addition to that, at Kid Rock's Q&A on Sunday, and the last question was, hey, Kid Rock, we'd follow you anywhere, even if it means the Bahamas and missing our wedding in Grand Cayman. Can we get a picture with our best man? And so all of a sudden he says, get on down here, you know. So he takes this picture. So now these guys have a picture of them with Kid Rock in the middle with his arms around them. And behind them is 2,000 people out on a deck on a Sunday afternoon. That's better than any wedding they would have had in Grand Cayman. And I don't even know what they had planned. So I'm saying, like, that story happens on every cruise, one or two of them.
I'm just curious, you're such a music lover. What kind of music do you listen to when you're in your car or with your family?
The things that will never go away, like the James Taylor, Jackson Brown, the things that I just really just allow. Those are my dreams. I mean, if I can get James Taylor or Jackson Brown on a cruise, like, that's going to be like the holy grail for me. Sarah McLachlan was that when she decided to come on the cruise, because we did a cruise with the Bare Naked Ladies and their friends, and she said, hey, I want to go on vacation. So she came and performed. And I remember meeting her and seeing her play, and she's just as pure an entertainer as it gets and a singer. She's just so good.
I would have never pegged you as a James Taylor or Sarah McLachlan fan.
Well, if it wasn't for James Taylor, I would not be sitting here right now, because he's the artist that made me want to pick up the guitar. But James Taylor was the drive that kept me up all night learning how to play guitar and hurt until my fingers bled. It still wasn't good enough to be plugged in, by the way. So, you know, glad I could shock you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.